to me. Thank you so much. Listen, we got a lot of ground to cover. That's a scary thing for the speaker to start after what Tim keeps saying about my open-ended closing time. But let me just take 1 minute before we start here and mention something else. I meant to mention it last Monday, but you know, we are in the midst of a very special season on the Jewish calendar. Do you know where we are? Rosh Hashanah was last Monday. Now, Rosh Hashanah means the head of the year, and we are now in the midst of what are called the High Holy Days, or the Days of Awe. And let me just background this real quickly. As a matter of fact, I'm gonna pretend to relate it to something that we're talking about here. The fact is, I've talked to you before about how God raised up Israel as a nation, as a people, to be a witness to the world. And one of the ways in which God framed that nation, and not just framed the cycle of their year, the rhythm of their year, was he, in Leviticus 23, he instituted three feast seasons. You have the Passover season in the spring. And by the way, real quickly, each one of these feast cycles, there are three in the spring, one in the summer, three in the fall. Seven total feasts. But each one of them, each of those cycles, Passover, Pentecost, Tabernacles, relates to the harvest. I didn't talk about this, did I? I was saying this somewhere. Because in the spring, you have the barley harvest. And you celebrate it at Passover with what's called the Feast of the First Fruits. First fruits are the barley. Then you work on the grain harvest, the wheat harvest, and bring that in and celebrate that at Pentecost, 50 days later, Pentecost, the Feast of Weeks, as it's called in the Bible. But then in the fall, and it's interesting that it's referred to, in the fall you have these three feasts. First of all, the Feast of Trumpets, and that is on the first of Tishri, Tishri being a month in the fall. And the Feast of Trumpets is just to establish that the High Holy Day cycle is beginning. And so beginning in Jerusalem and then resounding across the country and beyond, they would blow the silver trumpets in the synagogues to announce the beginning of the High Holy Days. And then 10 days later is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the most important and serious religious day of the year, the one day of the year where, according to the Bible, God demands that the Jewish people afflict themselves, which they have always taken to mean that they fast on that day. And then, on the Day of Atonement, of course, which is that hugely important day, that unspeakably important day, when the high priest would go that one day of the year. There were other times where he might go into the Holy of Holies for procedural issues, but the one feast where he enters into the Holy of Holies, does it three times, is when he goes in and takes the blood of a couple of animals, first a bull and then a ram, and he goes in and sprinkles that blood on the mercy seat, which is the lid of the Ark of the Covenant. Everybody remember this? So the Ark of the Covenant is that throne of God with the cherubim, and it's got the lid, which is called the mercy seat, and the cherubim dwells among it. In the box, of course, in the sacred box, the throne, are the tables of the law, which have been violated. So now you have this marvelous picture of interposing the blood of an innocent victim of God's provision. And only as that shed blood of an innocent victim is interposed between a holy God and the broken law can there be covering, atonements. That makes sense to you? A hugely important day. And then 5 days later, on the 15th of Tishri, there begins the Feast of Tabernacles. And that's a favorite of the Jewish people. It's coming up. They love the Feast of Tabernacles. Basically, and if this is new to you, when you think tabernacles in the Bible, you think of the tabernacle in the wilderness. It had nothing to do with that. Tabernacles are booths. And everybody constructs some sort of little shelter. And the shelter has to be open to the sky so you can see the stars, but you can cover it with enough to, you know, protect the rain and so on. And you're supposed to pretty much take your meals under that booth during the week of Tabernacles. And you are doing that because you are anticipating, well, I should say, first of all, the Feast of Tabernacles celebrates the harvest of what I call the hillside crops. In the summer, in the winter, you grow the grain and celebrate that in the spring and summer, Passover and Pentecost. But all summer long, you work on the hillside crops. And those are grapes and figs and pomegranates and olives and so on. And I always say, if the grain crops that you grow in the winter, those are necessary to live. The hillside crops that you grow in the summer and harvest in the fall, those are necessary to enjoy living. So much of what makes life pleasurable is a function of those hillside crops. And so for a week, you live under that booth and you are anticipating the kingdom. That's the picture of the kingdom. As a matter of fact, you always decorate your sukkah, your booth, your little tabernacle. You decorate it with tendrils of vines and fig trees and so on to represent every man living under his vine and his fig tree. Does that make sense to you? Now, it is interesting to me, because I'll make the point that I think here God puts Israel in the midst of the nations and intends to and does in fact accomplish this. He intends to put himself on display to the world through that people, Israel. And then he gives them this calendar, which three times a year they're going to stop, and they really do. They stop pretty much everything else they're doing, and they acknowledge that God and God alone can give you life. You celebrate the grain harvest, and God alone can give you the capacity to enjoy life as you celebrate the hillside. So it really is a deliberate way to draw Israel up as a people. Now, even to this day, the most irreligious, secular, confessionally atheistic Jew will almost certainly fast on the Day of Atonement. The Day of Atonement is next week from Wednesday, week from the day, the 9th. So, God built that cycle in. Now, let me bring it up to today. And this is a melancholy story. I emphasize it because I don't know if you have Jewish people in your circle of friends or work or whatever, but they're going to be thinking about these things over the next few days. I'll guarantee you. It's like no matter how irreligious the Gentile is, when Christmas comes around, he's thinking about Christmas. You can't escape it. And this is the high holy days, and we are in the midst of the days of awe. Now, let me tell you what's happened to this cycle in modernity, and this is universal. Number one, and this is just a curiosity, but the Feast of Trumpets, which happens on the Tishri 1, has become Rosh Hashanah, which means New Year, because the civil year, the agricultural year in Israel, always began on Tishri 1. So it is the New Year. Now, time out. You remember back here in the spring is Passover. And when God gave the first Passover, he said, "This shall be the beginning of months for you." So now the Jews have two calendars. They have a religious calendar that starts in the spring, but then they got the real one they live by. That's the civil calendar. So the Feast of Trumpets, they don't blow the trumpet anymore, has just become Rosh Hashanah. But it's about the same thing. But then this is what, throughout the Jewish world, is taught. And this is an unspeakable tragedy. The Jewish people believe that on Tishri 1, that is, last Monday, God inscribes the name of every human being on earth in one of two books. Are you familiar with this? The book of the dead or the book of the living. Now, all that means is that if your name is in the book of the living, you're going to survive this year. If it's in the book of the dead, you are going to die sometime this year. Now, that's nowhere in the Bible, so that's an unfortunate thing itself. But it gets worse, because what they mean by 10 days of awe is this, that you don't know, you have no way to know whether or not your name is in the book of the living or the book of the dead. Now, there's some measure of merit involved, so if you've lived like a skunk for 12 months, you got good reason to be suspicious. You know, your name's in the wrong book, but you don't know. You have no idea. And so, during the 10 days of awe, God gives you 10 days, just in case your name is in the book of the dead, to talk him out of it. That's what's going on right now. So this is a time when they try to make right any wrongs. They give a lot of alms. I could give you a lot of, but for 10 days they're working hard to produce a lot of righteous acts, so that just in case. And during these days, the standard greeting, and I don't know the Hebrew, I should, but that you greet one another for all these 10 days is happy sealing, S-E-A-L-I-N-G. When God seals the book on the 10th of Tishri, might it be happy for you. Does that make sense to you? Now, I say that's a melancholy set of ideas, simply because here's this one day of the year where God is most dramatically, most graphically making this blessed point that not by works of righteousness, but only as we trust in the shed blood of the innocent victim that God has provided, is there covering for sin. It's the season when the Jewish world today is the most deliberate and zealous about doing righteousness in order to please God. It really is as upside down as it could possibly be. But just know that we are in that season, and as I said earlier, it can be a good time to talk to folks that you know and so on, because I'll guarantee you, I don't care how irreligious they are, they're familiar with that set of ideas right there. And my wife worked for several years in downtown L.A. and worked for a very godless Jewish lawyer. But on the Day of Atonement, he was totally, totally disinterested in his Judaism. But on the Day of Atonement, he stayed home and fasted. I mean, it's almost universal. He was hedging his bets, quite obviously. But all right, with that background, let me say that's where we are. I should have mentioned it the other night. But now, we come back to the book of Daniel, and you have a set of notes. I went to two sheets here, but the first page is just like last night, but I want to make sure we're on the same page, so that is we're all together. So I say that chapters 1 to 6, these vignettes, and each one of them, God contrives to put his glory on display in remarkable ways and to make the case that even though Babylon and her gods have indeed conquered Judah, and it seems like Yahweh God, in point of fact, Yahweh God is in control, and he demonstrates his glory again and again. That's Daniel 1 to 6. Now, there is in Daniel 2 a very important prophetic, predictive a prophecy, but then in Daniel 7 through 12, you have these four remarkable prophetic visions. And I suggested last night, and this is what we talked about last night, that you really have kind of two prevailing themes, two elements. Let me just say once again, because we haven't been all together all night, but let me just say that Daniel lives at a time in sacred history, in the history of God's dealings with his people, where eschatology, end time events, becomes suddenly unspeakably important, because Daniel is going to introduce this reality of the times of the Gentiles. As I said a number of times, I think up until Daniel, a thinking, deliberate Jew could go to bed at night thinking, maybe tomorrow Messiah will come. No longer. Now Daniel has said there's going to be a succession of four world kingdoms. You're going to have to endure that, and he has spent some time, Yahweh has, describing what it's going to be like, and it's as horrible as you can imagine, and that is the history of the Jewish people in large part under Gentile dominion. But lest you despair, know that the God who knows the end from the beginning, the God who does keep covenant, is in fact allowing Israel, his covenant people, to be trampled underfoot of the Gentiles for a certain season, but he is going to rescue them for his name's sake, not because they're worthy, and he didn't call us to himself because we're worthy, but for his name's sake, because he made covenant with them. And to give them some measure of assurance of that, he begins to give them details. So as I said several times, we have before Daniel in the progress of Revelation in the Old Testament, we have anticipation of an end-time kingdom, and some indication of the glories of that kingdom. But it's only here that we begin to get detailed information about the drama which will produce, by which that kingdom will be established. And that drama, and by the way, let me take this sheet. Let me see if I can find it. I think I got it up here. No, I don't. All right, I'm going to go find it. I do this. This chart sheet. Now, I had this last night, and that's not what I want. Hold on, there they are. Now, we looked at that chart last night, but let me take it to this. You may have this chart in front of you. I did print it off. It's on the table back there. But I just want to say, and this is not our business here tonight, but it's going to relate to it. Listen, folks, I've said to you before that we live in a day in the evangelical world where eschatology, the doctrine of end time events, is largely disregarded. Regarded very, very contemptuously. I heard a man say one time, everybody was anxious to hear his lecture. He was going to talk about the book of Revelation. He began by saying, the key to the book of Revelation was lost in the first century and nobody ever found it since. So what's the use? That was his approach. Well, the fact of the matter is that God gave us Revelation, gave us this remarkable body of eschatological. Eschaton means end or last, so it's the doctrine of the last times. And it has to do with the drama by which God is going to, in fact, demonstrate his covenant-keeping character by fulfilling the promise to bring a generation of Israel to himself. That's the drama. And when you have to piece passages together to be sure, but you come together. This is the product of consistent literalism. And I'll not spend a lot of time with this chart other than to say that what it represents, this is important. See if you can figure it out here. I've made it myself, I want you to know. But I'm not good with graphics. I just, draw arrows. But so you have the first coming and then, of course, the cross and what we think of as, I say here, the present age from Pentecost to the rapture. Without getting at all into it, I do believe that it is interesting, by the way, that the state of Israel was born in 1948, but I better not get into that, shall I? But the next event on the eschatological calendar is laid out in Scripture, I think, is the catching away of believers of this age. I use the word church here in a way that I don't usually, but I'm talking about the body of believers who are alive at that time will be caught away. And now you have the end time period of 7 years plus. All right, maybe this. All right, just know this: that we and if you have only the most cursory familiarity with end time events, you probably know that there is this end time event known as the tribulation, which is supposed to last 7 years. Where do we get that idea? Well, I'm glad you asked, because it's right here. So you have this 7 year. Now, what the reason I'm emphasizing it, there's a lot about that chart which is a function of later revelation. But the basic construct, the outline, is right here in Daniel, or the chronological framework. So all I'm saying is we're not going to get deeply into the details. It's fun to do of the end time drama. And listen, do you find it curious that again and again in the New Testament, well, I say again and again, several times in the New Testament, especially in Paul, speaks of us as being in the last days. We are in the last, in these last days. All right, now think. To the Jewish mind, and I think this is biblically informed, human history is composed of two ages. And there is the present age and what they often call the now age. And then there's the Messianic Age. Now, for thousands of years, people waited for the Messiah. He came, but by reason of rejection, as the book of Matthew spells out so carefully, he did not bring the kingdom. And the kingdom was, I'll stand up and say it right in public, the kingdom was postponed. He said, no, this generation is not going to get the kingdom. So then he said, I am going to go away for a time, unspecified, but I'll come again, and when I do, as it were, I'll bring the kingdom. So in that sense, we are in the last days. We waited and waited and waited for Messiah. He came, and he said, I'm going to go away, but I'll come again. So we're just waiting for the Messiah. We're in the last days. That make sense to you? From that perspective. On the other hand, when we talk about the series of events which happen in the end time, we're talking about that end of human history, the end of this age, when a divinely described and orchestrated series of dramatic events began to unfold, which produce the kingdom. Does that make sense to you? Now, I'll take you the notes. I give you this this chart. I gave it to you before, but let me just spend a minute with this chart. You have it on your sheet. It may seem a little loopy, but I spent a lot of time on it. So there. So the point is that I would say that Daniel 2 and 7, the focus is on the times of the Gentiles. You have those four kingdoms twice given us. First a series of metals, then a series of beasts, and in each case it's followed by a fifth world kingdom, a stone cut out without hands, or a son of man who is dispatched to establish a kingdom. So the emphasis there, and again, we are in the, I think, the very much the latter days of it, but we've been in this times of the Gentiles for how long, by the way? For not 2,000 years, but for 2,500 years. All the way back to 586, you see. So we have been in the times of the Gentiles for a long time. We kind of get used to it. But imagine living in the days of Daniel, and you have this melancholy prophecy, this melancholy promise. There are going to be four kingdoms. So that's the times of the kingdom, and they're well characterized, both from a human and a divine standpoint, in Daniel 2 to 7. Now, the second emphasis is prophetic details of the end time drama. And we have, and that's what we're going to look at. We're going to do it quickly, but you have, first of all, Daniel 8. Now see if you can make any sense of this. Watch this now, because I give you the kingdoms up here. And Daniel 8 simply relates to the middle two kingdoms, Persia and Greece. We'll see it in just a minute. Then Daniel 9 gives us a foreview from the end of the Persian period all the way to the end of the kingdom, because it talks about the kingdom. And then Daniel 10 to 12 gives us just a foretaste of the end-time monster who is going to produce the drama that we remember as the tribulation. So that's what I'm trying to do in that. It doesn't even make that much sense to me, but I spent a lot of time with it, so there you go. All right, so this is what I'd like to do, and we're going to have to be quick about it to be sure. But I want us to survey these very quickly, these three prophecies, Daniel 8, Daniel 9, and Daniel 10 to 12. So, first of all, in Daniel 8 is one of the most stunning predictive prophecies of the Old Testament in its specificity. I said to you before that the critical, unbelieving, anti-supernaturalistic world which is offended by predictive prophecies already fulfilled, they despise that. They hate Daniel 8. Daniel 8 is, because the remarkable dynamic in Daniel 8 is that the two nations which are being described, and both of which are entirely future in the days of Daniel, are named Persia and Greece. So I give you the summary. Let me just say, I'm going to take you to Daniel 8, as a matter of fact. In Daniel 8, first of all, Daniel has a vision, and in his vision, he sees, right here, he sees standing beside the river was a ram with two horns. And the two horns were high, but the one came up after the other. Now, he's going to say that the ram is Persia. But you remember that Persia was, in fact, Medo-Persia, because it was originally a coalition between Media and Persia, but then Persia very much dominated. And we remember it even today as the Persian kingdom. Well, that's the ram. And then it says the ram was pushing westward. It was conquering. But then, he says, as he watched, a male goat came from the west. And what's remarkable is that the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. It was a unigort goat. But, you know, it's just a one big horn. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen stand by the river, and he ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him and attacked the ram and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him. But now watch this. All right, I'm going to get ahead of myself here. I think you know this, but so it's not. He is going to say, matter of fact, let's jump down there, his interpretation, and I'll come back to the little horn. Because he comes back, and he says, this is the angel who's going to interpret this for Daniel. So Gabriel says, look, I am making known to you what shall be in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be. The ram, all right, now let me stop on that. He's talking about something that's going to happen in the 300s. Not 300s B.C., so maybe 200 years after Daniel. But he says this is instructive about what's going to come in the latter times. What we are seeing here is God's way to prepare his people for those end time drama. I'll come back to that. So he says, the ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. So not left to any doubt. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. And then he says, the large horn between is the first king. Who's that? That's Alexander. But as for the broken horn, the four stood up, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. Now listen, what happened was, you know this, that Alexander, whose father, Philip, had been twice humiliated by the Persians, and Alexander put an army together and marched off. Alexander was... Alexander's a fascinating guy. If you've never read a biography of Alexander, I strongly recommend it. He's a fascinating guy. But he's a great tactician. Remember, the animal which describes Greece in chapter 7 is a leopard with wings and so on. And he had a relatively small army, but he was a great tactician, a great strategist. And at any rate, he was able to conquer the Persian Empire. He was angry, and he was able to conquer the Persian armies. So the ram is Persia, the goat is Greece. This is the second and the third of the four kingdoms. And but then it says this, all right? So that's the story. But that's not what teaches us about the end times. Does that make sense to you? He has given a prediction. It's a stunning prediction. Look, time out real quickly. We usually use the word prophecy to mean predicting the future, but it really means a lot more than that. So I want to be very, very specific. There are prophecies and there are predictive prophecies. A prophecy is just God, a prophet speaking. That's a prophecy. But what's stunning about this is it's a predictive prophecy. It's remarkably detailed. And I didn't mention that Alexander died at the height of his power, and there was a 20-year struggle. And when the dust settled, his kingdom was divided four ways, just exactly as the Bible says, and so on. So the fact is that this prophecy, this passage is more than a good guess, and that's why the critics stumble over it so they can't. So what do? You tell me. They late date the book. They say it was really an imposter writing after these events happened. Now, and by the way, here's an interesting thing. They used to tell us, now this was before I was around, but they earlier critics would say that probably this was written in connection with the Maccabean Revolt about 160 B.C., and you know, he made these things up. So they used to try and date it in the days of the intertestamental period. And by the way, Rome was yet to come, but they'd say, well, yeah, but Rome was on the horizon. That wasn't such a bad guess. So you could figure out that Rome was the next one, so the four kingdoms. But then guess what? At Qumran, which scrolls were written somewhere around 150 to 200 B.C., four copies of Daniel, so in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So they loved this book, and clearly it was around in the days of the Qumran literature. So at any rate, the point is that, come back to it. So you have a remarkable predictive prophecy that simply tells about these two kingdoms and the rage of the and the first the first ruler, being the great horn, all that sort of stuff. But now, notice what you have. All right, time out. I spent a little time with it last night, but remember, in Daniel 7, Daniel 2 and 7, we're going to assign to kind of the whole times of the Gentiles. But you had that remarkable prophecy in Daniel 7 about the fourth beast with 10 horns, and out of the 10 horns came a little horn. And that little horn shocked Daniel. Remember that? Because it continued to shout blasphemies and so on, even as the Ancient of Days was taking. So we already have the idea of a little horn who is a monstrous enemy of God and his people. All right? We got that in our... we already understand that. So now watch this. So now it's talking about same vision. Daniel 8, therefore the male goat grew very great. When he became strong, the large horn was broken in its place. Four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them came a little horn. All right, folks, do this with me. Can you name the four kingdoms? Babylon? Talk to me. Persia? Greece? Rome. In chapter 7, out of which of the beasts did the little horn arise? Rome. What beast are we looking at here? This is Greece. So, it's interesting, now out of the third beast comes a little horn. And notice what it says. All right, now this is on your sheet, but let me just stop. Well, I'll read it first of all. It says, there came a little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. What do you suppose that is? That's Israel. And it grew up to the host of heaven. This is the little horn, this monster. He cast down. It's not a monster like it's imaginary. It's a man. But he's a wicked, rapacious enemy of Israel. And it cast down some of the hosts of some of the stars of the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him, which is probably the high priest, by him the daily sacrifices were taken away. And the place of his sanctuary, of God's sanctuary, was cast down. And because of the transgressions, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. All right, now, the little horn in Daniel 7, which prophecy is still future, is this personage that we refer to later on as the Antichrist. Now, I didn't make much of this last night, but that's the first time. Daniel 7 is the first time we encounter the Antichrist. Folks, it is so significant to me, and it's so instructive, and I think it helps us get into the mind, if you don't mind, just a little bit of God and understand what's going on here, what he's doing. Because as he begins to give details of the end-time drama, the single most dominant focus is Antichrist. It really is stunning how careful God is to inform us about Antichrist. Now, we're not going to have to live with it. I believe we're going to be caught out of here. But there is a generation that is going to have to live with it, and the gospel is going to spread, and it's going to be so important for our people to understand, even in that terrible time, that God's in control. And this is his man, and he raised him up, and we have him all over the pages of Scripture thousands of years before he appears. That's Antichrist. But now, this fellow right here, this little horn out of the third beast, who is, now get this, he is future to Daniel, but he's history to us. His name is Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time with it, but you're welcome to read it. I give you some notes. It's very, very accessible. But Antiochus Epiphanes was one, all right, I said to you last night, that I think it was last night, but we talked about this just a little bit, that you had Israel was, when those four kingdoms, when the kingdom of Alexander was divided four ways, again, I did this the other night. You know, I worked to get a semester abroad program. This is the Mediterranean Sea, as any fool can see, and this, of course, is Israel. And I worked to get a program going over in Israel. I sent semester abroad kids over there. And after the first semester, a girl came back. It was kind of experimental. I asked her how it went. She said, it was great. We had a great time. But you know one of the best things? I finally figured out what you meant when you drew that little circle and that squiggly line, that bean-shaped thing. Well, okay. The circle is the Sea of Galilee, and the squiggly line is the Jordan River, and the bean-shaped thing is the Dead Sea. Everybody got that? So that's Israel. Well, the point is, to the north here is a general by the name of Seleucus. Talk about this. And to the south, Egypt, is a general by the name of Ptolemy. Now, again, these are Greeks. They're in the region of Egypt, the region of Syria, but they are Greeks. And this man produced a line of kings called the Seleucids. And a latter-day Seleucid was Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, for a number of reasons, and it was a great deal of intrigue, and by the way, central to his wicked campaign was that he kept changing the high priest. He kept putting a new guy in, and he got bribed to put a new guy in, and that angered the Jews. And then the story is, and it's a true story, that Antiochus was very, very, and notice it says that he was, he exalted himself, he grew exceedingly toward the south. Well, that would be Egypt. And he had designs on taking control of Egypt. Egypt belonged to the Ptolemies. But Antiochus had designs and made several forays in the attempt to capture Egypt. Also toward the east, he conquered all of Mesopotamia, the whole area to the east, which later becomes Parthia and so on. So he was a mighty, mighty king. And he had a great army. But there came a time, and this is a rather famous story, where he set out with his army to take control of Egypt. The Egyptians, knowing that they probably could not withstand him, had formed an alliance with a little budding, I don't want to say empire, but a country that had imperial designs to the north. You know who we're talking about? This is Rome. This is the first time Rome shows up. And they sailed by Cyprus, which is the team, and they came and met Antiochus on his way to Egypt. And this is when the Roman officer took his sword and drew a circle in the sand around Antiochus Epiphanes. Are you familiar with this? And said, before you get out of that circle, you decide whether you're going to go to war against Egypt. And if you are, you're going to go to war against Rome. And he decided against it. So he marched home in some shame, and in close connection with that, he had had a great deal of... You see, let me back up just quickly, and this is hugely important for a number of reasons. But understand that Alexander the Conqueror was also Alexander the Missionary. But he was not a missionary of the Christian gospel. He was a missionary of Hellenism. Now, the Greek word for Greece is helos. So Hellenism simply means the spread of all things Greek, including religion, language, philosophy, all this sort. And Alexander, whose personal tutor was whom, do you remember? Socrates, and had taught him to have contempt for all things. Matter of fact, they tell us that Socrates invented the word barbaric. Are you familiar with that? That... by barbaric. He thought that the Greek language was so noble that all the other language were gibberish and just sounded like bar, 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 bar. So he called everybody else barbar, you know, they were barbaric. Is there a noun there? I'm looking for the noun. But at any rate, the point is that Alexander, as he went across the Mediterranean world and established his empire, and beyond, all the way to India, he was spreading Greek culture. Now, again, in most places, there might be some pushback against that, but they're stronger than we are, okay. But in Israel, it produced... There were those in Israel, in the land of Israel, whose attitude was, look, they're in power, why don't we just play along, burn a little incense to a Greek god, make them happy, who cares? That becomes, in the New Testament Gospels, the Sadducees, all right? On the other hand, there were those who said, we don't care what the cost, we are going to give our allegiance to the law of Moses, that's what we're called to, no matter what it costs us, we are not going to embrace Gentile, Greek ways. That, in the New Testament, is the Pharisees. Now, I always say that we have, by reason of the way the Pharisees play out in the gospel narrative, we have a rather dismissive but not contemptuous attitude toward them. In many ways, we might, but they were a noble people in their genesis. They insisted, we are going to be loyal to Yahweh. Now, we could take that a lot further, but my point is simply that this became the grand issue in the Jewish culture, and it is to this day. Now, in terms of political issues and survival and military and so on, the grand issue is between Jew and Arab. But in terms of daily living and the issues you got to deal with and so on, the big struggle is religious Jew against secular Jew. They despise one another, and it's really ugly. So, now, what have they got to do with anything? My point is simply this, that's what Alexander demanded, and his latter-day ruler Antiochus Epiphanes had seen this work in most places, but the Jews resisted. And so finally, and the Jews were sometimes kind of given special dispensations. And so now, Antiochus basically outlawed Judaism. You're familiar with this. And he outlawed circumcision. He destroyed as many copies of the Torah as he could. He slaughtered thousands of Jewish leaders. And of course, ultimately, he slew a pig in the altar. And actually, just as bad as that, he raised an idol to his gods in the Holy of Holies. So he totally desecrated the temple, and he demanded that. Now, this is going, I'm not going to go here, but this is going to lead to, and we talk about the Maccabean or Hasmonean revolt in 167. And there ultimately by 143 BC, the Jews are going to be entirely victorious, and the rebels are going to drive the Syrians out, the Seleucids, the people from the north, the Greek descendants, are going to drive them out, by the way, for what it's worth. If this is, you know, here we go, to the east, here's the Mediterranean, here's a little Israel, and here's Syria. Over here is Parthia, and that's where the Seleucids were having the most trouble. So they had to give all their attention to putting down rebellion over here in the east, and so they kind of walked away from Israel and said, okay, you can have your religion, you can have your land, we're out of here. And that led to the rule of the Hasmoneans, that is the Maccabees and the Hasmoneans and so on, took control. It's all the same crowd. And when you get to the New Testament, and you encounter this man named Herod the Great, who is sent by Rome to subjugate Israel, to bring them under heel, what he's got to deal with is that Hasmonean family. But that's another thing. That's the intertestamental period. I come way back to it then. So the point is that you have this rather, not just rather, but this remarkably detailed, I say detailed, this specific prophecy of a end time, here is the interpretation. He says, now watch, I'm going to start again. Look, I am telling you what shall be in the end time. In other words, what you're seeing, even though it's only about 200 years off, is instructive of the end time, because here it is, in the latter time of their kingdom, well into the Greek kingdom, a king shall arise having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power will be mighty, but not by his own power. He usurped his brother's throne. His brother made his way to the throne. Then he usurped the throne. He'll destroy fearfully and prosper and thrive. He made himself very, very wealthy. Destroy the mighty and the holy people. That's exactly what he does. And he starts this horribly draconian, almost genocidal campaign through his cunning. He'll cause deceit to prosper. He actually wended his way into several influential families in Jerusalem, and secured them as his allies, and was at first received as a hero, but then he turned on and began to slaughter against the prince of princes. He'll be broken without human means. All of a sudden, at the height of his power, he dropped dead of some disease in 164 BC. Now, that is Antiochus Epiphanes. I'm going to leave it there. The point is, and let me just say this, that there is a reference here to, I missed it, 814, I think. I should mention this. That, all right, back up. In giving the vision, when Gabriel comes to explain, so Daniel sees the ram and the he-goat and the horn and the broken and so on. Gabriel comes to explain it, and then he says, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Look. Are you familiar with what's been done with this? These 2,300 days. Now, actually, let me see what my Logos has here. Literally, it says 2,300 evenings and mornings. Now, very quickly, folks, this verse got a bunch of Baptists into a lot of trouble about 150 years ago. This is the verse out of which Seventh-day Adventism arose. Are you familiar with that? And a Baptist by the name of William Miller proposed that this should be read as 2,300 years, and that dating from, I think, the Greek Empire, he added it up, and it came out to 1844. And he taught that Jesus was going to come in 1844. And it was wrong, obviously. As a matter of fact, just real quickly, some of his followers, when 1844 came and Jesus didn't, they said, well, we missed it just a little bit. I don't remember the date, but they put it off just a few more years, and then it happened again. Now, let me just do a little bit of an application here. This is wandering. But it's always dangerous to set dates, all right? Jesus said it's not given to him. It's not given. Don't pretend that you can. And the schemes are new every morning. I used to keep a file of them. And my favorite is a guy who said, you remember that when in John 21, that when they pulled the net out of the water, how many fish were in it? Anybody remember that figure? Numbers of the fish, like 158 fish or something like that. And I read a guy, I can show you, I have on my file, although I haven't opened that file drawer for 20 years. But he calculated the coming of Jesus on the basis of the number of fish. But he wanted it to come out to like 1987 or something, whatever everybody was fixated on for a while. And he was missing it. So he said, but Jesus was preparing breakfast, and he probably had at least two fish on the fire, so if he had the two fish in, then it came out right for him. Yeah, you get to thinking the wish is the father of the thought there. But the point is, here's what happens, and I think this is a bit of a morality tale, and I'm not getting after the Seventh-day Adventists, I'll tell you, but I'm not one, and I'm not a Sabbatarian, and I think they're wrong about many things, but they were pretty pure in the gospel. What happened is that because of their embarrassment over the fact that Jesus had not come on the predicted date, they said, no, we were wrong. He did come. But he didn't come to the earth. He came to the heavenlies and to a heavenly tabernacle where he has commenced the investigative judgment. And that investigative judgment is to determine whether we are worthy of the kingdom. Now, you see how easily that slips into work salvation? And that was the great bane in my mind, doctrinally, of this. Not just that they worshiped on Saturday, but this whole investigative judgment. Now, happily enough, years ago, I think it was in the 80s, a bunch of young Seventh-day Adventist pastors and teachers and said, just kind of corporately said, you know what, that's bunk. That's silly. We're dropping the whole investigative judgment. So they really, the gospel is much more pure. Now, they get the law too much mixed in there. But my point is that when you set a date like that, you often have to come up with something to cover yourself, and it's usually not healthy. Now, what is the 2,300? I think it's best to understand evenings and mornings as the sacrifices, because what's in the context? Remember there was a sacrifice in the morning and in the evening? Now, the evening, morning is sort of the Jewish day, but the point is that, so I think it's 2,300 sacrifices, because that's what's at stake. The temple is going to be desecrated for 2,300 evening morning. So I think it's probably the two sacrifices, which means half of that days, which is about 3 years and, 6 years and 3 months. I think it is without a doubt what's at stake is the time between when Antiochus desecrated the temple and the time when it was rescued by the Jewish rebels under the Maccabees. And of course, when it was rescued, they started a remembrance of that. And what's that? What feast do they have that remembers when they were able to rescue the... happens in December. Yeah, that's Hanukkah. It's called in John 10:22, the Feast of Dedication. Now, the problem is we can't identify the exact date. I think you could by taking 6 years and 3 months or whatever and count backwards. So we don't have the extra biblical data to prove that it was exactly that much time. Does that make sense to you? But I would say that from the time that Antiochus did, or his forces, first desecrated the temple, because that's what's going to happen. The Hasmoneans, the Maccabees, are going to mount a rebellion, and ultimately, in 3 years, almost to the day after the temple had been destroyed, had been desecrated, they were able to gain their way back in and gain control of it, and so on. And that is remembered as the Feast of Hanukkah. They rededicate the temple. Remember the story, by the way, real quickly, that the story is, and this is First Maccabees, they were able to make their way back and control the temple itself, the temple building. And they started to clear it out. But as they did, the golden lampstand in the holy place had gone out. The lamps, the seven lamps had gone out. And you were only supposed to burn the most pure virgin olive oil. And they didn't have a ready supply. But there was a little bit left in the lamps. So they deliberated, should we go ahead and light it, or should we wait till we get a supply? And they said, no, let's go ahead and light it. We're back in. And so they did. And the story is, I don't believe the story, but the story is that the lamps burned for 8 days, miraculously. And that's why the 8 days of Hanukkah. You remember the menorah with the eight lamps instead of seven. All right, I leave that all alone. The point is that the 2300 days, I think, just is the time of the desecration. All right, now I'm in such trouble, but we're going to be quick. All right, let me take you then. Whoops, that's not where I want to be, although I do. Daniel 9. Now listen, folks, this deserves a great deal more attention than I'm going to give it. But Daniel 9 is universally known as the prophecy of the 70 weeks. And that's not what I want. Where's my notes? All right, so here I give you some notes on Daniel 9, and I say here that it is, these are the notes you have in your lap, it is the chronological framework. Now, what's really interesting, and I should have a lot more, I mean, I wish, but I asked the question down here. Notice the events that led up to it. And it's worthy of mention very quickly. So now, in Daniel 9 and verse 1, we're told that it's the first year of Darius. So this is after Daniel 5. And the Babylonians have been displaced by the Persians and by Darius. And we said before, it's hard to know for sure who Darius is, whether he's Xerxes or... But I think maybe Cyrus. But at any rate, the point is... in the first year of his reign, he understood. So look at this. I understood by the books. You know what? I got to stop on that so quickly. There is the notion, folks, and this is really an aside, but there is the notion in the minds of so many believers that, well, let's start this way. It's a legitimate question. Why are these books in the Bible and none other? Right? It's called canonization. And there is this notion that the business of deciding what books would go in the Bible was late, hundreds of years later. And that, like in the New Testament, I always say, somewhere in Rome, about 400 years after Christ, a bunch of guys sat around a big table, maybe with high hats, and said, everybody for 2 Peter, raise your hand. You know, okay, 2 Peter's in. Everybody for 1 Peter, oh, too bad, didn't make the cut. Folks, that is such a silly, lying set of ideas. The Bible, books of the Bible were added as they were written. And they were added for one reason. And that is because they were written by, in the Old Testament, a prophet. And we know he's a prophet because he does miracles to prove it. Or in the New Testament, by an apostle. And we know he's an apostle because he does miracles. God objectively, undeniably. Now, there's a lot more to this. We get into it. But the point is that there's nothing subjective. There's nothing retroactive about it. As here's a prophet. And this is really a stunning example. Where I'm going is that it says that Daniel was reading in the books, and the word that he uses there, it's clearly a reference to the sacred scriptures. And what he's reading from is Jeremiah. And Jeremiah was an early contemporary. And what's really stunning about this is that Jeremiah's generation despised him. Remember that? Because he was crying out, submit to the Babylonians and so on. They despised Jeremiah. But don't you know, when he wrote a book, they put it in their scriptures. Because they could not deny that he was a prophet. And that's how the Bible grew. Books were added immediately. I can show you this again and again, Old and New Testament. This idea of a bunch of books floating around and hundreds of years later saying, take that one and that one, no, not that one. No. That is fiction. It never happened. There's no indication either historically. I know I can get into Eusebius' Antilegomena and so on, but that's a but I'm telling you, even the, okay, better not go there. But it happened as a, so here is Daniel. He's reading from the books of Jeremiah, who their lives overlap significantly. Now Jeremiah's gone by now because Daniel's an old man. But he's understood by the books through Jeremiah the prophet, he names him, that he would accomplish 70 years. Now that is twice, I won't go there, we said it before, Jeremiah 25:10 and Jeremiah 29:11, twice God had said through Jeremiah, you're going to be in captivity for 70 years. Daniel knew arithmetic. He's gotten old. He realizes he's within 2 or 3 years of the 70 since he was first brought here. And so he set his face. He wants to know what comes next, and he begins to pray. Now, he says, I set my face toward the Lord to make request. And so he's praying, and he tells us his prayer. Now, I like to say that what's curious is here is he prays for all of those verses, and then he says this, while I was speaking, praying, and confessing my sin, the sin of my people, that's Daniel 9, and presenting my supplication before the Lord, yes, while I was speaking, he's making a big deal of this, the man Gabriel, whom I'd seen in a vision earlier, being caused to fly swiftly, reached me about the time of the evening offering. And he informed me, and he talked with me, and he said, oh, Daniel, I have now come forth to give you skill to understanding. At the beginning of your supplications, that's the beginning of this chapter, the command went out, and I came to tell you. I think he's, you know what I'm saying? He flew swiftly. Now, to me, this is fascinating. Because, again, angels are created beings. Now, in some sense, they're non-corporal or spirit beings. So I think we don't understand it real well, but it's not Casper the Ghost. But they function without what we think of as a physical body. But they can only be in one place at a time. It takes them a certain amount of time to get from here to there. And they can go either fast or slow. And if you want to know how fast, it's too bad. I always say it, distance equals rate times time, right? We only have one of the three here. We got time. Because you can just read Daniel, those first 27 verses, and that's how long it took him. If we knew distance, we could know how fast he could go. And if we knew rate, we could find how far it is he had to come. But there is a place, a spirit world, he had to leave, and it took him that long to get there. Does that make sense to you? So he's come swiftly because Daniel is praying. But then he says this, and I'm just going to walk you through this very quickly. He says, oh, there's so much here. And by the way, this is not so much a vision. This is just, he's telling him. This is a revelation. This is a propositional revelation. He says 70 weeks. All right, weeks means sevens. That's what the word is. And it's without a doubt, take my word for it, it's not sevens of days like we think of weeks. It's sevens of years. Now, that rattles strangely in our ear, but would that be foreign to a Jewish listener, did they live in cycles of 7 years? You bet they did. Remember, every year was the Sabbath year. How came God to decide they would be in captivity 70 years? Do you know? It's explicit in Jeremiah. Grant? They had, exactly. For 5 centuries, they had neglected the Sabbath year. And he said, the land is going to get its Sabbaths. So I'm going to take you out of the land and give a rest for 70 years. So my point being that the whole idea of a cycle of 7 years is not only very, very common to their culture, but it's very much a part of their experience, the reason they're here. So without any doubt, you can't make any sense of it, and it makes perfect, you can't make any sense if you go any place else, but this would not be at all foreign or difficult. 77s, literally, 70 Shavuot, 77s are determined for your people and for your holy city. Now watch this. To finish the transgression, make reconciliation for iniquity, bring in everlasting grace, seal up the vision, anoint the most holy. Folks, I don't want to develop, I'd love to, but I'm going to ask you, what he's talking about there is to bring in the kingdom. the long-awaited kingdom where Israel will be brought as a nation, as a generation to repentance and so on. He's saying it's going to take, so here we are in the first year of Belshazzar, some 550 B.C., and Daniel is told that there are going to be 70 sevens. That's 490 years. But it doesn't begin with Daniel. He says, know therefore and understand that from the going forth of a command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. That's the command given to Nehemiah. Now, there's debate about this, but it's, believe me, it's the only way that fits, and it fits perfectly. That command was given on Nisan 1, 444 B.C. by our, I don't remember the our calendrical date, but Nisan 1, 444 B.C. And it says, from the going forth of the command to rebuild and restore Jerusalem unto Messiah, the prince, shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. So that's 69. So the first 69 weeks will get us to Messiah. Now, I'm not going to develop this. I've talked about it elsewhere, and there are a lot of debates about this, but for my money, this is Harold Honer's calculations, among others, but I Harold Honer is the most important evangelical, solid chronologist, biblical chronologist of our day. And in his book, Chronological Aspects of the Life of Christ, he develops this, and he shows that from Nisan 1, 444 B.C., you count four, and there are some, you got to take it as prophetic years of 360-day years and so on. By the way, I have become persuaded, because I listened to a couple of really fun guys on podcasts. I'd recommend them to you. But there is a lot of evidence that in the beginning, the cycle of a year was 360 days. And you know what's made it longer? Earthquakes that have shrunk the earth a little bit. But at any rate, you can't make any sense of this. And when you look at the chronology of the book of the flood in the book of Genesis, it's clearly 360-day years. So if you take this as 360-day years, number one. And number two, there are 69 of them. So 69 sevens. I'm sorry, there's 69 sevens, so 483 years. When, and Honer works this out, when you start with Nisan 1, 444 B.C., count forward that many days, it brings you, I've adjusted Honer just slightly here, but I'm not going to go into it, it brings you to March 29th, 33 A.D., which is, in fact, the day of the triumphal entry. And I think, and it's interesting that when Jesus rode into the city of Jerusalem, he said, oh, Jerusalem, if only you knew what belonged to you on this thy day. And there's a verse in the 118th Psalm, I say all the time, that everybody in the room knows by heart, verse 25. Do you know the verse I'm talking about? I can start it, you can finish it. This is the day, exactly, which the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. And I tell people all the time that we use that verse all the time. You get up in the morning, throw open the drapes, you know, this is the day, I'm going to rejoice. Help yourself. But that's not what the psalmist is talking about. He's not talking about this day or that day. He's talking about one day, and it is March 29, 33 A.D., and it's the day of Messiah's appearing. This is the day. That's the point. You remember at the triumphal entry, Jesus' enemies tried to get his disciples or the children to stop crying out. And Jesus said, if they don't, the very stones will cry out. Why? Because this is the day which only God could provide. The day when the Genesis 3:15 seed of woman that had been promised all those centuries ago finally appears. This is the day which only God can provide, the day when a deliverer appears and we will rejoice and be glad in it. Now, I think that's what's at stake here, that you have a really tight prophecy here. Do what you will as to, there are various ways to read it, but certainly what it says is that from the going forth of that commandment, Nisan 1:44, on to Messiah the Prince, and it's going to come out in the days of Jesus, is 483 years of 360 days each. By his calculus, 173,880 days, and it brings you right down. All right, leave that alone. Not leave it alone, but... And he says that this seems to be talking about the fact that Jerusalem will be restored, because from the going forth of a command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem onto Messiah... from the going forth of the command unto Messiah will be 483 years of 300, and during that time the city will be restored. And that happened under Nehemiah. Then he says this. Now this is important. Time out. I'm just going to level with you. There is a lot of discussion as to why he didn't just say 69. He said 7 and 62. They seem to be consecutive. And I think probably the 7 weeks is primarily the ministry of Nehemiah rebuilding the city. But then there will be another 62 cycles of 7 years each. So between the two of them, it's 69. But down here he says after the 62 weeks. In other words, after this block of time right here. Am I making any sense to you? After the 62 weeks, two events will happen. Now, this is huge on two counts. Number one, on any number of counts, but that I want to mention. Two events after the 62 weeks, which I would say after Messiah presents himself in the triumphal entry. Number one, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. He won't bear any guilt, but clearly that's the crucifixion. And then it says, the people of the prince who is to come. Now, who is this prince who is to come? And I think that has to be informed by Daniel 7. That little horn that was going to shout great blasphemies and so on. So the people of the prince who is to come, and this, I talked a little bit about this slightly different approach to things, but this is why I say it seems to be Rome. I mean, it was Rome that did that, but at any rate, shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and that is 70 AD. Now, and then, now watch this, then he, and again, the he is the same as the prince, the people of the prince, and the prince is the Antichrist. So he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. That's the 70th of the 70 weeks. We already had 69 of them, 69 weeks up until Messiah. Then two events happen, then the 70th week. Now, what you have here, and it really is revelational genius when you think about it, is you have a timetable, but it has a rather accordion gap, and we are living in that gap. So after the 69th week, there are two events before the 70th week, which means there is a gap of time. We're in that gap. And there is 1 week yet to come. A week is a cycle of 7 years, and that 70th week is the tribulation. The only reason, folks, that believers, since the New Testament, since for all this time, have believed that the end time drama will involve this final awful week, which comes to be known as the time of Jacob's trouble, or Jesus refers to it as tribulation, such as never been before seen, and so we call it tribulation. Now, all we're told here, well, I'll read it, that he will confirm a covenant with many, and I think the many here is Israel, for 1 week. Now, interestingly, we're not told what that covenant is. This end-time personage who is so cruel, so anti-God, is going to confirm a covenant with, and that's universally taken, and it's really no one else do it, with Israel, for 1 week. But we're not told what the covenant is, but we're told what happens when he breaks the covenant. In the middle of the week, he'll bring an end to sacrifice and, oh, I didn't mean to do that, but I'll take it. He'll bring an end to sacrifice and offering. Now, if in fact, breaking the covenant is to bring an end to sacrifice and offering, doesn't it follow that the essence of the covenant is enabling sacrifice? Does that make sense to you? Folks, real quickly, this is if you take this literally, I think quite clearly, there will be this end-time personage. We know him as the man of sin. We encounter him as the man of sin in Thessalonians and so on. We know him generally as the Antichrist, that the Antichrist is going to, through some stroke of diplomatic and or military genius, he is going to provide for the Jewish people to rebuild their temple so they can reestablish their sacrifices. Now, do you understand the dynamics of this? There's only one spot, I can take you there. You can't go inside. But there's only one spot on the face of the earth where the Jews would ever consider building a temple. It's where the first temple of Solomon stood. It's precisely where the second temple, built by Zerubbabel and improved by Herod, it's where it stood. But today, there is above that spot what? The Dome of the Rock. So now there is this Islamic holy place, it's unimaginable. I say unimaginable. That's not quite true because everybody has a different imagination as to how. But it's hard to know how the Antichrist is going to affect that sort of covenant treaty where the Jews are allowed to rebuild their temple. Now, I want to say again that up until, I think I said this the other day, but let me just remember, up until about 20 years ago, there was no interest on the part of the Jewish world to rebuild the temple. But then just a few years ago, maybe 25, there arose two outfits. One has become dominant. They were called the Temple Institute and the Temple Faithful. And they both began to teach that, yes, it is up to Messiah to build the temple, and we must wait for Messiah to do it, but the reason he hasn't come to initiate the rebuilding of the temple is because we haven't taken the initiative. And if we showed more interest and more determination, and so today they are building, they built all the implements, they built the solid gold menorah, which stands in a public place, well guarded, thank you, in a square in Jerusalem. They've got a little shop where you can go, and they'll show you how they've studied carefully, and they've built all the implements in the temple, and even the shovels and all this sort of thing, as well as the furniture. They train men, they'll take young men, and they're not real fussy. They think that they may have developed a DNA test to identify the tribe of Levi. But short of that, if your name is anything that sounds like priest, like Cohen or Khan or anything like, or even Levi, they'll take you in, they'll provide for you, they'll train you how to be a priest. All of this in anticipation. Matter of fact, you go to their shop. It's kind of a nice shop. I'm not real crazy about it, but I'll show it to you if we go together. But there are all sorts of things for sale, and there are these signs. Say, all proceeds will go to the building of the third temple. And I always say, I'm not buying anything in there because I don't want any plaques on the wall of that apostate temple. The bookman paid, you know. I'm looking for a fourth temple, thank you, but because that temple is going to be destroyed, and Messiah is going to build a temple. But this is an apostate temple. But it just takes my breath away, honestly, to realize that we live in a day when there is such a deliberate passion to have their temple. They made a great big 18-ton cornerstone for the new temple, and they put it in the back of a two-wheeler, and they started wheeling it into Jerusalem. Not two-wheeler, that too, but an 18-wheeler, and they started to wheel it in. And, of course, the police came and stopped them. It was a big riot. They made them put in a warehouse. And every year, right about this time of year, because they think it might happen in connection with Tabernacle, they come and they bring that thing out, and the police have to come make them put it back away and so on. So the point is that there is a lot of focus today on building. Oh, they're longing for the temple. And they think they have it in their sights. Well, I'm going to tell you something, not just here. And I should finish, because what's going to happen is in the middle of the week, this Antichrist is going to break the covenant, and now, and let me just say, Daniel 9 establishes a seven-year end-time drama. Revelation 4 to 19, well, one could say 6 to 19, is the detailed unfolding of the events of that seven-year period. To understand, I mean, the two go together absolutely hand in glove. Daniel 9 establishes the chronological framework. We've got 7 years divided in half. Revelation 6 to 19 is just the seals and the trumpets and the bowls, and all of that is the unfolding of the actual details of that seven-week period. Does that make sense? So it really is stunning, A, the degree to which God gives us details. And I think, again, it's interesting to us, and sometimes people get a little upset because you get too focused on it, and there are some issues that are a little hard to sort out and so on. But I think, frankly, the primary audience for which God intends that, and this is kind of unusual, is the generation that actually lives through it and can see it unfolding and be encouraged that, hey, God is in control. You know, be able to say, I know it's going to happen tomorrow. It's going to be awful. But at least we know that it's of God. Does that make sense to you? And he hasn't surrendered lordship over this earth, and all of this is going to eventuate in a generation of Israel that comes to bows its knee. All right, so that's Daniel 9. All right, so let's just review real quick. You got Daniel 8, which gives you the overview, that gives you an insight into this little horn. It doesn't give you, it reveals this early little horn called Antiochus Epiphanes, but that's to help you understand what's coming in the end time. Now Daniel 10 to 12, and this is a remarkable passage. And I've written out a lot of the details. Let me just take all of Daniel 10 to 12 is one vision. And one of the most interesting dynamics of this vision, I'm going to be very quick, is the angelic activity. Folks, I'm telling you, it's only in the last several years. I read a book by Mike Heiser. You know Mike Heiser? He used to teach at Pillsbury for a lot of years. Got Dave Burgraff led him to the Lord. Pardon me? Played baseball for you? Yeah, yeah. Was he a good first baseman?
Yes.
I'll remember that. I'll remember that. He'll be congratulated that you have thus characterized him. But Mike worked for Logos Bible Software for a lot of years and so on. Just left it just a couple months ago. Is leading a Bible Institute down in Florida now. But at any rate, now I got to warn you, but I would recommend his book, The Unseen Realm. I would cautiously recommend it. So stay close to your pastor and others as you read it, because Mike does have some strange ideas, and he jumps the rails about every 10th page. He's whoop, where? But what he does is just drive home out of Psalm 82 this absolutely unmistakable, undeniable biblical reality that there is a spirit world. And that spirit world, as I said the other night, is active. It's not a play act. There is a real drama. There's a real battle. And you don't have it anywhere, I don't think, in the Scripture so well spelled out as right here, where, first of all, you have in Daniel 1, Daniel, he says, on the 24th day of the first month, as I was by the side of the great river, the Tigris, I lifted my eyes, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen. This is, I think, a Christophany. This is a pre-incarnate appearance of God. But then, there is a second spirit being, and that is an angel. And a hand touched me, which made me tremble, and so on. And this is what he says. He says, he calls him greatly beloved again and again, Daniel. But he says, do not fear, Daniel. For once again, he says, from the first day that you set your heart to understand, to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard. And I have come because of your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia, now this is evidently, quite clearly, another spirit being. And it's a spirit being that was, who was assigned to oversee the deception and so on in the area of Persia. Seems to be some territorial dynamic going on here. Gabriel had been called from Persia to come to Daniel. But somehow in this spirit world, this fourth dimension, fifth dimension, I should be saying, out there, there was a, because I'm leaving out time, but there was a struggle. And finally, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I'd been left alone there with the kings of Persia. So he says, I've come to make you understand. And so he touched my lips. And so now you have this remarkable vision. And notice what he says here in the end of the chapter, verse 20. He said, do you know why I've come to you? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia. So I got to go back there. There is a genuine angelic struggle. It's knockdown, drag out. I don't know what it looks like. Doesn't look like your science fiction video games, you know, but it's a real spiritual struggle. And he's got to go back. And then he says, and when I have gone forth, indeed, the prince of Greece will come. So in other words, the prince there is some angelic being who's going to represent. So he's struggling with Persia, and he knows, he has the same prophecy as you do. I don't think the angels know the future unless they got it in the Scriptures, and he knows already that after Persia is going to come Greece. So he's, you know, I've got to go back and struggle with Persia. And when he's done, I'm going to have to work with, you know, struggle with the prince of Greece. But he says this, I will tell you what is noted in the Scripture of Truth, the Book of Truth. Now, I think the references to this passage right here, I'm going to write it down in a book so that You can know the truth. And then he gives this remarkable prophecy. Now listen, on your sheet, and it's fascinating. Like I say, one commentator I read said that there are, in this chapter, 135 specific predictive prophecies, names, dates, relationships, events, and so on, in one very compact area. And it makes it a little difficult to work your way through because you have so many people, so many events and so on. So I say here, I'm just going to read it to you a little bit. It's awfully small even in front of me here, but this is what you have on your sheet. The angel outlines future events beginning in 11:2. From Antiochus Epiphany, verse 2 refers to four Persian rulers. You can identify them. There they are. It alludes to Xerxes' campaign against Greece, which happened. Then there is reference to Alexander the Great, the division of his kingdom once again. And then for several verses outlines the relationship between the Seleucids, these guys that I mentioned before. They're called the kings of the north, because if you're in Israel, to the north is the Seleucid Empire. And then also reference to the Ptolemies and their struggle in the intertestamental period. And then it comes once again to Antiochus Epiphanes. So, in verses basically 2 to 35, you have stunning detail. And again, this is something that the unbelieving, critical world who rejects the possibility of the supernatural and thus therefore predictive prophecies just can't deal with. But they can't deny. They have to lay data. They can't deny that what's being talked about here is exactly what happened in those intertestamental years. But they'll lay data to get away. But what I want you to see is it brings us all the way down to Antiochus Epiphanes, and there's a great deal about this horrible... He's the little horn guy of chapter 8. So, do you see where I'm taking it? Once again, God is arming people who are going to endure this to realize that Antiochus Epiphanes is God's way to give you some foreglimpse of what the terror is going to be like. I'm going to say once again, when Daniel wrote this, Antiochus Epiphanes in himself was future. Today, we can look back and rehearse the sorry and wicked career of Antiochus Epiphanes, but God intends for us to say, you know what, that's just a hint of what's coming. That's the point. Because what happens... And really, nobody will deny this. I mean, it's really unmistakable. Because he's talking about the wicked campaign and destruction of Antiochus Epiphanes. But all of a sudden, right here, in verse 36, and might I say, he doesn't stop and say, you know what? This is all a picture of the Antichrist. But all of a sudden, he begins to describe things about that won't fit Antiochus Epiphanes. Just don't fit. And we already have Daniel 8, 7 and 8, if you don't mind. 7, the little horn of chapter of the fourth beast. 8, the little horn of the third beast. So we already have this construct. And all of a sudden, I think this is, everybody would acknowledge almost, that this is the description of the Antichrist. And the king shall do according to his own will, exalt, magnify himself above every god, speak blasphemies against the God of gods, prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. That's divine wrath, but the point is, until God has accomplished his purposes, for what has been determined shall be done. He'll regard neither the God of his fathers nor the desire of women, and you know that there are a lot of different interpretations, but it's none of them happy. Exalt himself above them all, and so on. In their place he shall honor a God of fortresses. He'll worship his own strength, his own military prowess, and so on. He'll act against the soul. And then it goes on to say this. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. Now listen, folks, I'm just going to say it's late, and I'm not going to work you through this carefully. But the battle described right here, beginning in verse 40, is, frankly, one of the most difficult predictive prophecies, I believe, with two or three fibers of my being, if you know what I'm saying. I mean, you could talk me out of it. But I think the best way to understand this is that this is a battle which occurs probably in the middle of the tribulation in connection with when Antichrist sets aside, in other words, he allowed the Jews to build their temple and they're worshiping Yahweh. Now he sets himself up and demands worship, and he sets out, and there is warfare. He has enemies, and so he's going to move against the king of the south shall attack him. I think that's Antichrist. The king of the north will come against him, and I think, again, there's a lot, but he'll enter the glorious land, Israel. Many countries shall be overthrown and so on, but what I want you to see right here. So he's going to go down. I think what this is saying is this, that when Antichrist does seize control of the entire world, that there will be rival kings who will move against him. One of them, as is in the past, will be from the north, another will be from the south. He'll go down to conquer Egypt. The king of the north will come through. Now, this is my reading of it. It's difficult. But the king of the north will come through and he'll go down to Egypt. Watch this. News, I think he's in Egypt at this point, from the east and the north shall trouble him. Frankly, all right, this is, there's a lot about this is difficult. But I think what it's saying is this. Remember in Revelation 13, we are told a lot about this Antichrist. And one of the most remarkable elements is that he shall receive a wound unto death. But that wound will be healed. And I think the point is that he will be killed in battle, but then he will come back to life. And when he does, he becomes almost Satan incarnate, and that's when he sets himself up in the temple and so on. And I suggest, and only that, that the king of the north, who has perhaps inflicted that wound upon Antichrist, now hears, he's gone down to Egypt, he hears news out of the north and east, that would be Israel. And I'm putting two and two together, and could be I'm getting 22, but you have to study it on your own. But I think the best reading of this is that the news will come that Antichrist has come back to life. And that's why the king of the north will return, but now he'll be slaughtered. And the Antichrist, and this is the second half of that 70th week. And so now he goes out with fury to destroy and so on. So it's a difficult eschatological passage, to be honest with you. Many people put it at the end of the tribulation as part of Armageddon. Others put it before the tribulation, whatever this battle is and the various people involved. I don't know that being able, I have to confess, I don't think, I'm not comfortable that we can, in fact, be dogmatic about exactly the battle that's being defined here, but or being described. But what it means is that Antichrist is going to come to absolute power. And now, again, this is so carefully and helpfully fleshed out when you go to the Book of Revelation. Book of Revelation is much more detailed and the chronology is much more exact, and it certainly leads us to that same conclusion that Antichrist is going to become absolute in his power, and he's going to reign for 3.5 years. He's going to slaughter all that he can, but there are going to be those who are saved, and there are going to be, of course, during this time, there are going to be 144,000, 12,000 each of the tribes to go out to evangelize, preach the gospel, and a great number that no man can number, is going to come to truth. So Daniel 10 to 12 is here, it seems to me. It's the what God is trying to say is, once again, you need to be prepared for what's coming. And the best way to understand it is to look at this intertestamental figure called the Antiochus Epiphanes, and even in the telling of it, he rather subtly shifts from the career of Antiochus to the career of the end-time Antichrist, and what we're told is it's horrible. Well, finally, it says that when the Antichrist is at the greatest power, Michael shall stand up, and he will come and do battle, and the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, there will be a time of trouble such never was a nation even at that time, and at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. And then it says, many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. That's one of the most important. Look. Old Testament saints understood the resurrection. Job anticipated the resurrection. So it's not only late in Old Testament revelation that you get references to the resurrection, but this is one of the most explicit. So there will be a resurrection. Those who are wise shall shine and so on. So, Daniel 10 to 12, one set of ideas. Daniel's praying. The prince, Gabriel comes. He's been resisted by the prince of Persia. He gives him this remarkable revelation that there is a, he lays out in such detail the intertestamental period and the struggles between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids and the high priests and so on. But then he transitions into this Antichrist because that's the point. You need to be prepared. But he leaves us with this marvelous message that Michael is going to come, the great deliverer, and do just that. So again, you have this marvelous close where he says, close up the days and so on. I want to mention one other thing that's really an interesting way that this ends. At the very end of the book and the Revelation, he says, blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. And as a matter of fact, I got to go up. From the time of the daily sacrifice is taken away, that's the middle of the tribulation, until the abomination and the domination of desolations, there will be 1,290 days. All right, real quickly. It's late and I've lost it, but let me just say this because it really is important. It's a remarkable little tidbit of revelation that we're not given anywhere else. But we know this is explicit in the book of Revelation, for instance, and this is one of the reasons I would argue that the years are 360 days. But we know that from Revelation 13, when the Antichrist sets himself up as to be worshipped and so on, the middle of the tribulation, until Revelation 19, when the white horse rider descends, is 1,260 days. That's what we're told. But here we're told, blessed is the one who survives for the 1,290 days. And then it says, it enlarges on, blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. So the fact is that you have an extra 30 days here, and then an extra 45 days. That make sense to you? Come to the 1,290 days, that's an extra 30 days. And then blessed is he who comes to the 1,335, that's an extra 45 more. So there's 75 days right at the end. I think what Daniel would have understood is this, that after the carnage of the battle that's just been described, there's going to have to be some cleanup, if you don't mind. And when you go to Revelation, you remember that after Armageddon, the birds of the earth are called to devour the carnage of Antichrist's armies. Remember that? And then you have Matthew 25, which is the judgment of the sheep and the goats, and only the sheep go into the kingdom. Remember this? Listen, as the kingdom begins, only believers are in the kingdom. All right? And that's the sheep and the goats. There will be millions of people who survive the tribulation physically. Not all of them will be believers. The sheep and the goats, Matthew 25, is determined who goes into the kingdom of Messiah. And so I think the first 30 days, you got 30 days and 45. And this is total conjecture. What you have explicit in the text is this extra 75 days. The only place in the Bible you have it, you don't have it in Revelation. So I'm going to suggest that, and this is pretty universal among literalists, that the 30 days is very possibly cleaning up the carnage of the Armageddon. And then the 45 days is the sheep and the goats. So that by the time the kingdom begins, the earth has been purged, the lost have been consigned to outer darkness, and living mortal believers have gone alive into the kingdom that Jesus establishes. That make sense to you? So that's where this whole thing is headed. All right, listen, we're done. You've been very patient. But I do give you on your notes just sort of a summary. And right at the bottom of the page there. And we've been here a number of times, but I think it's good for us just to reinforce this in our minds. What are we learning here in this book? Number one, God's glory will not be compromised. He is going to honor his name regardless of the circumstances. But secondly, and it's just as important perhaps, God's word will not be broken. And he's made covenant promises, and he is going to fulfill those promises. in the business of fulfilling those promises. There are some end time events which are more horrific than you can imagine. I got to tell you, I had a good friend who had a church in L.A. and he'd have me come and preach now again. And one morning, he had seven services. How do you like that? So it was a lot to do, but in a real big building. But it was a full weekend to preach for him. But one day he came and he said, "Bogan, I don't want you to have a sermon. I just want you to answer questions." So, okay, fine. So we just took questions. People came with questions. And a woman came and she said, "You know what? I've been reading the book of Revelation, and I am really mad at God." Well, that's not appropriate, but I understand what she was saying. And she says, "I read that, the carnage, the destruction, the suffering, it's gut-wrenching. I could hardly get through the book." And I told her, I said, "Look, you have experienced what John the Apostle experienced in Revelation 10, where God gave him a book to eat, remember that? And he said, it'll be sweet to your mouth, but it'll be bitter in your stomach." And I think the point is this. Every one of us is hungry for the wickedness of this earth to be put right. Are we not? And it will be a sweetness when God does in fact move in and accomplish that redemption. But when you contemplate what it's going to involve, And it's going to involve this because this is what it's going to take to bring Israel to the end of herself. This is a kind cruelty. Does that make sense to you? This is God doing what has to be done, what he has to do in order to bring Israel to himself, to the end of herself and thus to himself. But it is desolation beyond almost what we can think about. And therefore, God forewarns his people so that when it comes, they can realize that God is in this. That makes sense to you? And the centerpiece of it all is this remarkable individual that we come to know as the Antichrist. Put it all together, and I'll say what I said last night. Human history is about God's glory. And God has orchestrated and is orchestrating human history in such a way that he is going to put his glory on display, his covenant-keeping character. He's going to do it by keeping his promise to this people, Israel. And in order to keep that promise and bring them to himself, there is an end-time drama which is gut-wrenching to think about, but which God has carefully prepared us for, and which, in point of fact, you know, dispensationalists have oftentimes regarded the tribulation as the judgment upon this age and so on. I don't think that's the point at all. I don't think that's the point at all. The point is that, I say it again, God has made a promise, and he's not going to just abracadabra. He doesn't do that, folks. He's going to bring this people to the end of themselves in such a way that they will, by their own will, I won't say free will because I got enough Luther in me, but I'm saying they are moral accountable, and they will by their... They'll look upon the one whom once they pierced, and they'll cry out with grace and supplication, but through all eternity, they will praise God as the author of that redemption. And it was by reason of what he brought into this world and into their experience that they did, in fact. I'm going to say it again. The only reason you're a believer is because God brought you to the end of yourself. It might not have been quite as dramatic. It wasn't, I trust. But that is what God is doing. Does that make sense to you? And Daniel is where he begins to talk about it, where God begins to talk about it because of where Daniel lives. All right, thank you again for your kind attention. It's ridiculously late, and you've been very patient. Well, you know, I say that. You may be shaking your fist in your mind, but you've been very patient, and thank you again, Tim and the elders of the church, for the opportunity. Let's pray together. Father, again, we worship you. We worship you, first of all, for who you are, and you are our maker. You are the creator of all things. You are, and it is for your sake and the sake of your Son that all of these things were and are created. So we honor you, and we acknowledge that it is appropriate that you be worshipped and honored. It's bottomlessly and infinitely inappropriate that we try to make ourselves the object of praise and that we pretend that the world is about us, but It is infinitely appropriate that you be the object of man's praise and worship and adoration, that men know you are right. And so, Father, we thank you that in the pages of Scripture you have, to a very finite degree, but in a way that we can absolutely trust, you have laid out your plan. And in so many ways, it delights our souls, and in certain ways, it distresses our minds as we contemplate the terror that's going to have to befall this earth and these people in order to bring them to the end of themselves. But Father, we worship you as a God of grace and as a God who keeps covenant. And Father, again, I'd pray that we might be that this reality that we serve a God who keeps his word might be ever more precious to us. And we'll thank you in Christ's name. Amen. All right, take the rest of the night off, right, Tim? Good heavens.